June 11th, 1955. Salt Lake City, Utah. 22-year-old Jocelyn Hickenlooper, who suffers from developmental disabilities and scoliosis, vanishes without explanation from her home. Over 2 weeks later, Jocelyn's decomposed body is discovered in a shallow grave located near Parley's Canyon. After a 2-year investigation, a developmentally disabled suspect named Burt Murphy confesses to killing Jocelyn, but after he recants his confession and the murder charge against him is dropped, a judge rules Burt to be legally insane and he is committed to the Utah State Hospital. When the Utah Supreme Court overturns this decision in 1988, Burt is released from the hospital, but there is a lot of doubt about whether he was actually responsible for Jocelyn's murder. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and on today's episode, we're going to be exploring a very sad and unusual cold case from Utah, the 1955 murder of Jocelyn Hickenlooper. This is officially the first episode of our 7th year as a podcast, and the main reason I'm covering this one now is because Utah is the last remaining state from where The Trail Went Cold has yet to cover a case. So now that this episode has been released, I'm happy to announce that our podcast has hit the milestone of featuring at least one cold case from all 50 American states. When I was searching for cases to cover, I came across a very interesting post at the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit written by a poster with the username Jules in Utah, who once co-hosted a true crime podcast of her own with her sister titled Zion's Lost, which did their own episode about this story and is a great resource to learn about lesser-known cases from Utah. The story of Jocelyn Hickenlooper really stood out to me because it involved a victim and an accused killer who both suffered from developmental disabilities, and since this took place back during the 1950s, when the world wasn't exactly an enlightened place when it came to the subject of mental health, there have been a lot of questions about how this investigation was handled. The prime suspect, Burt Murphy, only had an IQ of 65, and he first popped up on the radar when he was arrested for the unrelated rape of a young girl, and while he was being questioned, he made a full confession to Jocelyn's murder. However, Burt soon recanted his confession, but the case took a unique turn, because instead of going on trial, Burt was ruled to be legally insane and committed to a state mental hospital for the next 3 decades. So even though no one was ever convicted of Jocelyn's murder, and the case was not officially solved per se, the police were so certain that Burt Murphy was the perpetrator that they closed the case after he was sent away. But looking back, there are a number of sizable holes in Burt's original confession, and some other pieces of evidence, including an eyewitness sighting of Jocelyn in the company of 2 unidentified individuals at the time she went missing, which seemed to point to someone else being responsible for this crime. No matter which way you look at it, this is a pretty bizarre and baffling case with a number of unanswered questions, so on this episode, we're going to take our first trip to the Beehive State and try to make some sense out of what happened. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now delve into the unsolved murder of Jocelyn Hickenlooper. Thank you. Our story begins in Utah in 1955, and our central figure is 22-year-old Jocelyn Hickenlooper. Jocelyn has a number of developmental disabilities, and physical ones as well, as she suffers from scoliosis and has a hump on the right side of her back. For 3 years, Jocelyn had lived at the Utah State Training School in the town of American Fork, a care facility for individuals with developmental disabilities, but she is currently living with her family at their home in a residential neighborhood on Denver Street in Salt Lake City. Jocelyn's father has been deceased for nearly 13 years, so she is now under the care of her widowed mother, Lottie Hickenlooper, and also lives with her older brother Wally and younger sister Suzanne. On June the 11th, Jocelyn was excited because she just happened to be 1 day shy of her 22nd birthday, and she was also looking forward to singing in a Latter-day Saints music festival that night, being held at the Salt Lake Tabernacle. Jocelyn spent the morning at her residence while her brother Wally was laying tile in the bathroom, and a repairman from the telephone company also stopped by in order to move the house phone. After he completed his work and checked in with his employer, the repairman left the house at noon, and would later say that he saw Jocelyn in the living room reading a letter. Shortly thereafter, Jocelyn answered a phone call from a friend of her sister's and told her that Suzanne was not home, but within minutes of the call ending, Jocelyn would inexplicably vanish without a trace. After being out for the morning, Lottie Hickenlooper returned home at 12:17 p.m. at the exact same time Wally was leaving in order to go out and purchase some more tile. Lottie soon noticed that Jocelyn was not at the residence, and Wally would later tell his mother he did not see Jocelyn leave and had no idea where she was. When Jocelyn did not return home for lunch, Lottie was not overly concerned, but when several hours passed and Jocelyn did not show up for dinner or in time to perform at the music festival that night, Lottie became convinced that something was wrong and contacted the Salt Lake City Police Department to report her daughter missing. Since Wally had been the only person present at the home when Jocelyn disappeared, he was extensively questioned by police, but ultimately ruled out as a suspect. However, there would be an interesting eyewitness account from one of the Hickenlooper's neighbors who claimed she had seen Jocelyn walking away from the residence with two individuals. Since the neighbor wasn't paying close attention to the situation, she cannot provide any details about these two people or even identify their genders, though she thought they might have been two women, or one woman and one man. But the neighbor was able to provide a detailed description of Jocelyn's appearance, as she claimed she was wearing a red housecoat and red slippers, and her hair looked unkempt. This seemed very out of character for Jocelyn, who always tried to make herself look as neat and presentable as possible whenever she went out in public. In addition, Jocelyn also left behind a coin purse she always carried and her eyeglasses at the house, even though she was nearsighted and needed her glasses to see properly. Jocelyn would remain a missing person for over 2 weeks until a man who had been collecting topsoil in the wooded area of Parley's Canyon contacted the police on the evening of June the 28th and reported that he had uncovered a body inside a hastily dug shallow grave. The location was near the Salt Lake City limits, approximately 15 miles away from the Hickenlooper residence, and after the victim was recovered, she was soon identified as Jocelyn. She had been struck over the head 3 times with a blunt instrument and had a number of abrasions on her face, and she was also clad in the same red housecoat her neighbor had seen her wearing when she left the house. Due to the level of decomposition on her body, it was impossible to determine if Jocelyn had been sexually assaulted or figure out how long she had been dead. But since an autopsy would find traces of sand particles in Jocelyn's lungs, this meant she had been breathing and was technically still alive when she was buried. After a homicide investigation was launched, a search of Jocelyn's room would turn up a truly bizarre piece of evidence. A stack of printed invitations which read, quote, "Mrs. Lottie Hickenlooper invites you to attend the wedding of her daughter, Jocelyn Hickenlooper, to Jerry Brown of Ogden. The wedding will take place at the Liberty Ward in Salt Lake City, June the 12th, 1955. End quote. Of course, June the 12th was the day after Jocelyn went missing, and Ogden was located nearly 40 miles north of Salt Lake City, but needless to say, this discovery took everyone by complete surprise. Lottie was completely unaware of these invitations, which were apparently ordered by Jocelyn herself, and as far as her family was concerned, Jocelyn was not even involved in a relationship at that time, let alone engaged to be married. This discovery made investigators speculate that Jocelyn might have initially run away to elope with her fiancé before something went horribly wrong, which led to her being murdered. Well, it turned out that Lottie was casually acquainted with a 25-year-old man named Jerry Brown, who lived in Ogden and was employed by a printing firm. When Jerry was tracked down and questioned, he was just as shocked as everyone else, as he claimed that he barely knew Jocelyn and denied that he was romantically involved with her. Jerry appeared to have a strong alibi on the day Jocelyn went missing, so investigators did not consider him to be a suspect in her murder. They wondered if Jocelyn might have arranged for the wedding invitations to be printed as part of some elaborate fantasy she was living out, so it was possible they had no connection to the crime. Some of the earliest reporting on this case stated that Jocelyn was seen in the neighborhood pharmacy on a few occasions with an unidentified man with a mustache and a dark complexion. This guy apparently stopped showing up at the pharmacy a short time after Jocelyn was killed, and there were also reports that a man with a mustache had been seen near the location of Jocelyn's burial site at Parley's Canyon in the days following her disappearance. However, it doesn't look like this lead ever went anywhere, and over the next 2 years, police would interview over 200 persons of interest who had a history of sex crimes, but were unable to turn up a promising suspect. However, the case would take an unexpected turn after another horrific crime took place on the morning of September the 10th, 1957. A 4-year-old girl, whose name was never released publicly for obvious reasons, was playing outside her aunt's home in Salt Lake City before she was taken by a man to nearby Memory Park. This person proceeded to sexually assault and beat the young girl before choking her into unconsciousness, but after he fled the scene, she managed to recover and wander out of the park, where a group of tourists found her and called for help. Later that evening, the girl gave a description of her attacker to the police, and within minutes of this information being circulated, a patrol officer happened to notice a 19-year-old man named Burt Murphy riding his bicycle down the street. Since Burt matched the description and was wearing similar clothing to what the girl said her attacker wore, the patrol officer took him into custody. After the girl identified Burt in a police lineup, he would confess to the assault, and even took investigators to Memory Park to reconstruct what happened. Burt had a number of developmental disabilities, as he was illiterate and only had an IQ of 65. For nearly half his life, he had lived at the Utah State Training School in American Fork, but was discharged from there in July of 1957, only 2 months before the attack on the girl took place. Burt had a reputation for being a troublemaker, and the school did not believe they had the proper facilities to keep him under control, so he went to live with his parents in the suburb of West Jordan. It turned out that Burt had become acquainted with Jocelyn Hickenlooper during the 3 years she lived at the training school, so after he was charged with raping the young girl, police decided to question him about Jocelyn's murder and gave him a polygraph. When Burt failed the test, he finally made a full confession to the crime. Burt referred to Jocelyn as his quote-unquote best girlfriend during their time together at the school, and said that he always danced with her. When she was discharged from the school in 1954, Burt claimed that Jocelyn gave him her home address, so he decided to pay her a visit 1 year later. According to Burt, on the morning of June the 11th, 1955, he traveled to Jocelyn's residence and knocked on the back door, and when she answered, he asked if she would go out for a walk with him. Jocelyn initially said no, so Burt left, but when he returned to the house a short time later and asked Jocelyn out for a walk again, she said yes. He said they walked just over 5 miles to a flat area located at the mouth of Parley's Canyon, and it was here that Burt said he started making advances towards Jocelyn. When she resisted, Burt started choking her before he proceeded to sexually assault her and hit her on the head with a rock. Afterward, Burt said that he dragged Jocelyn to a hole and used his hands to throw dirt over her body and bury her. Much like when he confessed to sexually assaulting the 4-year-old, Burt took investigators to the scene of the murder in order to reconstruct what happened. He was subsequently charged with first-degree murder, and 1 month later, a preliminary hearing was held in which a district court judge ruled that Burt needed to undergo a sanity hearing before they proceeded any further. This decision was met with objections from Burt's public defender, who believed he could conclusively prove that his client was innocent of the murder, regardless of his mental state. By this point, Burt had recanted his original confession, and when a reporter asked him why he would admit to a crime he didn't commit, Burt replied, quote, "I wanted to be a big shot. I've always wanted to be a big shot," end quote. Since Burt had been questioned by police without an attorney present, there was speculation that his confession might have been coerced. Regardless, the sanity hearing still took place, and featured testimony from two court-appointed psychiatrists who examined Bert and concluded that he had antisocial tendencies and recommended that he be placed under maximum security. In the end, the judge ruled that Bert was legally insane, even though the court made no findings as to the nature of his insanity or the type of mental illness that Bert might have been suffering from. However, it was determined that he was mentally incompetent to stand trial for both Jocelyn's murder and the rape of the 4-year-old girl, so the murder charge was dismissed, and the rape charge was indefinitely stayed, and the judge ordered him to be committed to the Utah State Hospital in Provo. It would not be until July of 1972, when a judicial hearing was held to determine that Bert was competent enough to stand trial for the rape charge. A bench trial was held in December of that year, in which the judge found Bert not guilty by reason of insanity and sent him back to Utah State Hospital. Even though Bert was never officially convicted of Jocelyn's murder, the Salt Lake City PD pretty much closed the case following Bert's arrest, as they maintained that he was the right guy and had provided a number of details about the crime that only the perpetrator could have known. However, there were a lot of troubling inconsistencies in Bert's confession, and officials from the Utah State Training School publicly expressed their belief that he could not have been the killer because records showed that he was at the school all day on June the 11th, 1955. They also claimed that Bert had a tendency to make up stories, and his disabilities could have made him susceptible to confessing to a crime he did not commit. Bert maintained that he left the training school that day after the morning check and returned in time for their evening check. He said there was a substitute attendant on duty when he got back who asked him where he had been, so Bert told the attendant he had gone into town to phone his parents. But even if Bert's story was true, there was some question about how he could have made the 30-mile trip from American Fork to the Hickenlooper residence in Salt Lake City. Bert originally told police that he stole a used car from a dealership in American Fork to make the drive, and returned it there after he committed the crime, though he wound up leaving bloodstains on some seat covers, which had been torn from the upholstery. However, there was no record of any vehicles being reported stolen from any car dealerships in American Fork on that date, and even though investigators got in touch with these dealerships to follow up on Bert's story, none of them had any recollection of finding bloodstains in their vehicles. When Bert was charged with Jocelyn's murder, the Salt Lake police chief flat out acknowledged this troubling inconsistency and shared it with the media, but it seems like Bert eventually revised his story to say that he hitchhiked from American Fork to Salt Lake City and back, stating, quote, "I only told you that I stole a car because it makes me sound like a bigger guy," end quote. But a number of holes still remained in Bert's confession, such as when he mentioned walking past a zoo with Jocelyn right before they arrived at Parley's Canyon, even though the only zoo in Salt Lake City at that time was actually located near Emigration Canyon. In spite of this, Bert continued to remain a patient at the Utah State Hospital, but by the time the 1980s rolled around, his case caught the attention of a public defender named Brooke Wells, who felt that Bert had been unjustly incarcerated and agreed to take him on as a client. Wells appealed the original district court ruling in which Bert was declared to be legally insane, claiming that this ruling was part of a deal which was made between the prosecutors and the hospital, and that Bert had no chance of being rehabilitated while he was there. Wells also argued that if Bert had pled guilty to his crimes and was sent to prison, he already would have served the maximum sentence by this point and been released. The case would be taken all the way to the Utah Supreme Court and featured testimony from a number of doctors who believed that even though Bert suffered from a number of developmental disabilities, they did not consider him to be insane. In June of 1988, the Utah Supreme Court ruled that Bert's insanity ruling had been a mistake and admonished the state for the inability to provide the necessary services to improve Bert's mental state. The court was now ordering for Bert to be released from the Utah State Hospital after having been a patient there for over 30 years. For over a year following the ruling, Bert lived in quarters on the edge of the hospital property and held down an outside job while the state figured out what to do with him, as there was fear that Bert would have a hard time readjusting to society after being institutionalized for the majority of his life. By 1990, Bert was moved into a supervised group home to live alongside three other men in the city of Orem. However, once word got out that the man believed to be responsible for the murder of Jocelyn Hickenlooper was a free man again, there was a public outcry from his new neighbors, who stormed a city council meeting to protest. Over the next few years, Bert would be transferred around between a number of different group homes, though this was usually met with hostility from neighbors who did not want him living in their area. Bert did have a few run-ins with the law for such incidents as attempting to steal a dog from a neighbor's residence, which earned him a sentence of 3 years probation with 24-hour supervision. And he would be arrested and spend time in jail on a few occasions for losing his temper and assaulting his survivors. One person who was particularly opposed to Bert's release was Jocelyn's younger sister, Suzanne Jessup, who suffered a nervous breakdown following Jocelyn's murder. By this point, Suzanne was married and had 2 sons, but the new publicity surrounding her sister's case caused her mental health to deteriorate, and she reportedly had struggles with schizophrenia. According to her family, Suzanne seemed genuinely frightened that Bert was going to come after her, and once went through a meltdown after becoming convinced she had seen Bert in a grocery store. Throughout the 1980s, Suzanne had attended all the court hearings pertaining to Bert's release, and a new hearing was scheduled to be held at the Utah State Capitol building on April the 15th, 1991. When Suzanne went to the building that day, she suddenly fell from a third-story balcony onto the rotunda floor and died at the age of 52. Since there were no signs of foul play, it was ruled that Suzanne's death was a suicide. As for Bert Murphy, he spent the rest of his life living in various group homes before he passed away in March of 2001 at the age of 63. The Salt Lake City PD has held the position that Bert was Jocelyn's killer and have never reopened the investigation into her case, but there is a lot of doubt about whether justice was actually served, and a number of people believe that the real killer managed to get away with it. So I guess you could say the trail went cold. Anyway, it took me 6 years to cover a case from Utah on The Trail Went Cold, but I'm hoping it was worth the wait, because this was a very strange story, albeit an incredibly sad and enraging one. Of course, one of the biggest challenges with covering this case is that it took place during the 1950s and involved 2 individuals who had developmental disabilities, so not surprisingly, most of the original media coverage was not exactly what you would call politically correct. Hell, even up until the 1980s and early 1990s, the coverage of Bert Murphy's release used the word retarded to describe him, which was technically the correct clinical term back then, though it obviously wouldn't fly today. Hell, if you search online, you can find the original Utah Supreme Court ruling about this case from 1988, and it uses that word several times. Just 4 months before this episode's release, KTVX Channel 4, Salt Lake City's ABC affiliate, covered this story as part of their Justice Files series and had to put a disclaimer about the common usage of that term back then. Now, it's no big secret that there are a number of wrongful conviction cases out there in which someone with an intellectual disability or a low IQ was coerced into giving a false confession. Even though there's a lot more awareness about this issue now, the idea of confessing to a crime you did not commit was probably unthinkable to most people back in the 1950s, even though Bert Murphy recanted his confession. When Bert was released from Utah State Hospital during the later stages of his life, he had to face constant harassment from people who were convinced he murdered Jocelyn Hickenlooper and did not want him in their neighborhood. I mean, it's an understandable reaction, but Bert was technically never tried or convicted of that crime, and most people who believed he was a murderer were probably not aware of the problematic issues with the case against him. From a legal standpoint, I'm not even sure if the authorities still consider Jocelyn Hickenlooper's murder to be unsolved, because we have a suspect who spent over 30 years in a mental institution for his alleged role in the crime, but that's technically not the same as a conviction. If he had gone on trial for the murder and was found not guilty by reason of insanity before he was committed to the state hospital, which is exactly what happened when he was tried for the rape of the 4-year-old, then yes, that would count as a definitive conclusion. But instead, Bert was declared to be legally insane by a judge before he got the chance to present a case for his innocence in court. So even though the Utah Supreme Court ordered Bert to be released from the hospital 3 decades later, he technically wasn't exonerated per se, since he wasn't even convicted of the crime in the first place. This wasn't a double jeopardy situation, because theoretically, if new evidence had surfaced against Bert after he was released from the hospital, they could have charged him with Jocelyn's murder again. And if new evidence surfaced against an alternate suspect, they still could have been charged with the crime as well. But I'm guessing the authorities felt that Burnt was the right perpetrator all along, and his 30-plus years of incarceration was justice enough, so they never bothered reopening the case. So this is a rather unique situation, as I don't believe I've covered a case on The Trail Went Cold where both the victim and her alleged killer had developmental disabilities. In spite of her disadvantages, it sounds like Jocelyn Hickenlooper never caused much in the way of trouble, and even though she probably still needed assistance from a caregiver, I get the impression she still had enough independence to function in day-to-day life. But by comparison, it sounds like Burnt Murphy had an extremely difficult time functioning in society, as I don't think he received the same amount of love and support that Jocelyn got from her own family. He acted up and got into constant trouble both before and after his time in the state hospital, and it sounds like he was one of those people who slipped through the cracks, because there was just not the appropriate support system in place to provide proper care for someone like him back then. Even though a lot of experts believe that Burnt's commitment to the hospital violated his rights, they still expressed their concerns about allowing him to be a free man again, since he was so ingrained by institutionalization. In fact, Burnt's alleged assault of the 4-year-old girl took place only 2 months after he was discharged from the Utah State Training School, and even though the school faced heavy criticism for letting him go, they maintained that they just did not have the proper facilities to handle him. Now, the attack on the girl from September of 1957 adds another complication to the story, because even though Burnt's supporters believed that he was railroaded for Jocelyn's murder, it doesn't sound like there was much lobbying to have him exonerated for this particular crime. Like I just mentioned, he was technically found not guilty of the rape by reason of insanity, but that doesn't mean he didn't do it. Obviously, there wasn't going to be anything conclusive like DNA back then, so it seems like the primary evidence against Burnt was his own confession, and the victim positively identifying him as her attacker. Granted, a 4-year-old's memory is not always going to be reliable, but she ID'd him on the very same day the incident took place, so her memory still would have been fresh. I've never seen any accusations that Burnt's confession to this crime was false, only that the police may have taken advantage of the situation to make him a convenient scapegoat for Jocelyn's murder. Indeed, the attack on this 4-year-old was so heinous that if Burnt really was the perpetrator, then it shows he was capable of horrific violence. Hell, this girl's attacker also choked her, and you get the impression that he attempted to kill her and leave her for dead, but since he didn't finish the job, she managed to survive and get help. So it's easy to believe that the same person who harmed this girl could have murdered Jocelyn in a similar fashion. Before I talk any more about this case, I want to briefly discuss another unsolved murder which took place in Salt Lake City during this time period, as the earliest media coverage of Jocelyn's case made frequent comparisons between these two crimes. The victim here was a 6-year-old boy named Gregory McComb, who lived in an apartment building which happened to be located only a half block away from the Hickenlooper residence. Gregory's mother, Lorie McComb, was a divorced single mother and had to work her job at a tavern on the evening of September the 16th, 1954, so she left Gregory alone at their apartment and asked a friend of hers to periodically check on him. When Lorie finished her shift and returned home during the early morning hours of September the 17th, she discovered that Gregory was missing from his bed. One of Lorie's neighbors would report having seen a vehicle pull up in front of the building shortly after midnight, before a short, stocky man wearing a red shirt and striped bib overalls climbed out. He walked into the building and emerged a few minutes later with Gregory in his arms before placing him inside the vehicle and driving away. Several hours after Gregory was reported missing, his body would be discovered in a rocky creek bed at Parley's Canyon. He had also been sexually assaulted and strangled before his skull was fractured with a blow to the head with a blunt instrument. What's particularly interesting is that Gregory's body was found only about 1/5 of a mile away from the spot where Jocelyn Hickenlooper would be buried in a shallow grave nearly 9 months later. The most promising suspect in Gregory's murder was a truck driver named Norman Ash Fackrell, who was a friend of Lorie McComb. Lorie kept a key to her apartment underneath the mat by the front door, which Gregory's abductor likely used to go inside, and Fackrell was reportedly one of only 3 people who knew that the key was there. Nearly 3 years later, in August of 1957, Fackrell was in jail on a reckless driving charge and after using this as an opportunity to interview him about Gregory's death, police finally decided to charge him with first-degree murder. Backrell had been in a tavern on the night Gregory was killed, and witnesses recalled that he was wearing a red shirt and bib overalls, the same clothing the neighbor described Gregory's abductor as wearing. Backrell's alibi was not particularly strong, as he claimed that he left the tavern at around midnight, drove to a loading dock, and fell asleep inside his car until 3 a.m. However, when Fackrell went on trial for the murder, the neighbor who witnessed Gregory's abduction could not identify Fackrell as the perpetrator, and she was unable to provide a description of the suspect's vehicle either. Aside from his recent arrest for reckless driving, Fackrell had never been in trouble with the law and had no known history of violence. There was also no direct evidence to link Fackrell to the murder, and the state's case against him was so shaky that the jury deliberated for less than 3 hours before they found him not guilty of the crime. After the trial, it sounds like the investigation into Gregory McComb's murder was pretty much closed, as the police continued to believe that Fackrell was the perpetrator, and since they wouldn't be able to try him again due to double jeopardy, there wasn't anything else they could do. While I do have issues with his alibi, I really have no idea if Fackrell was actually responsible for this crime, and I definitely agree with the jury's decision to acquit him, because the case against Fackrell was very weak, and there was plenty of reasonable doubt. But of course, the main reason I'm mentioning this case here is because of the potential connection to Jocelyn's murder, as these crimes took place only 9 months apart, Gregory lived only a half block away from Jocelyn, and the bodies of both victims were found at Parley's Canyon in spots which were in very close proximity to each other. Now, obviously, the victim profiles are much different, as I'm not sure if someone who abducted and murdered a 6-year-old boy would be inclined to do the same thing to an adult woman who was one day shy of her 23rd birthday. But due to her disabilities, Jocelyn was described as almost having a childlike personality, so I guess anything's possible. Theoretically, since Norman Ash Fackrell was not actually charged with Gregory's murder until 1957, he would have had the opportunity to harm Jocelyn 2 years earlier, but I've never seen any indication that he was considered to be a potential suspect in this case. And I seriously doubt that Burt Murphy was responsible for abducting Gregory, as he had no known connection to the victim, and was still living 30 miles away at the Utah State Training School in 1954 without any access to a vehicle. But could it be possible that the same perpetrator was responsible for murdering Gregory and Jocelyn, and in both cases, the wrong person was falsely accused of committing the crimes? The whole situation is really quite frustrating, because we have separate eyewitnesses who likely saw each victim being abducted by the person responsible for the respective murders, yet they didn't get a good enough look at the abductor to make a positive identification. And what's particularly troubling about the eyewitness sighting in Jocelyn's case is that she was supposedly in the company of two people. So let's break down the events on the day Jocelyn went missing, as it sounds like there was a very narrow window of time when her alleged abduction could have taken place. We know there was a phone repairman at the Hickenlooper residence who checked in with his office at around noon and maintained that Jocelyn was in the living room when he left. This is corroborated by the fact that a friend of Jocelyn's sister called the residence and spoke to Jocelyn, and we know this call had to take place after 12 p.m. because the house's phone had been disconnected all morning. Jocelyn's mother Lottie maintained that she arrived home at 12:17, by which point Jocelyn was gone, so we're talking about a window of around 17 minutes, maybe less, in which she could have been abducted by an outside party. If you're wondering about the phone repairman, I don't see any indication that he was considered to be a suspect, as I can only assume that the police were able to verify his whereabouts for the rest of the afternoon. If he made other house calls and kept checking in with his office, then this would rule out the possibility of him driving 15 miles to Parley's Canyon in order to murder and bury Jocelyn. Now, I can understand why there might be suspicion about Jocelyn's brother Wally, as he was at the house laying tile in the bathroom when Jocelyn disappeared, and claimed that he never saw her leave and did not report anything unusual. However, Wally was extensively questioned and ruled out as a suspect. He was seen leaving the residence at the exact time his mother returned home in order to go pick up some more tiles, and if his whereabouts weren't accounted for during the next several hours, then yes, I'd find that highly suspicious. But I'd like to think that police were able to confirm Wally's story and verify that his purchase of the tiles actually took place. Now, in the Reddit post I mentioned during this episode's intro, there were a couple of commenters who had their suspicions about the Hickenlooper family and wondered if perhaps they might have decided to get rid of Jocelyn because she was too much of a burden to care for. Hell, they speculated that this might have been some dark family secret which overwhelmed Jocelyn's sister Suzanne with so much guilt that she decided to stage a very public suicide at the Utah State Capitol building 36 years later. Well, I see no indication that Jocelyn's family were ever considered to be suspects, and if they really wanted to get rid of her, it would have been a lot easier to commit her to some institution, or at least lie and claim they put her away somewhere. Being that this was the 1950s, people likely would have believed their story without much question, and that approach certainly would have garnered much less attention than reporting Jocelyn missing and turning her disappearance into a major public spectacle. I see no reason to believe that anyone from the Hickenlooper family was involved, and we do have the eyewitness sighting of Jocelyn being escorted away from her residence by two individuals before her mother even returned home. So let's talk more about this eyewitness sighting, which is a pretty unusual one, as the neighbor was able to recall specific details about the clothing Jocelyn was wearing, yet she claimed she didn't get a good enough look at the other two people to even determine what gender they were, though she believed at least one of them might have been a woman. I can understand why people might be skeptical about the credibility of the sighting, but it turned out the neighbor's description of Jocelyn's clothing was accurate, as she was clad in a red housecoat when her body was dug up weeks later. I get the impression that Jocelyn had not yet gotten dressed after she woke up that morning, which is why she was still wearing her housecoat and slippers at noon, and the neighbor also described Jocelyn's hair as being unkempt. It sounds like Jocelyn always made sure that her appearance was presentable whenever she went out in public, so even though the neighbor did not describe the scene as a forceful abduction, I get the impression that someone made Jocelyn leave her house against her will. But what could these two people have said to Jocelyn to convince her to leave without making a scene or alerting her brother? Honestly, it greatly troubles me that this eyewitness sighting seemed to be completely disregarded once Burnt Murphy was charged with Jocelyn's murder, because it completely contradicts his own confession. In every version of his story, Burnt claims that he showed up at the Hickenlooper residence alone and convinced Jocelyn to leave and go out for a walk with him, but how does this account of the neighbor's sighting of a second person? Even if Burnt was actually guilty, shouldn't there have been more of an effort to try and figure out who the second individual might have been? Somehow, Burnt Murphy does not strike me as the type of person who would be committing crimes with an accomplice. Of course, if one or both of the individuals seen with Jocelyn were women, then this only opens up more unanswered questions. The most logical theory has always been that Jocelyn was abducted and murdered by a sexual predator, and yes, I know that women can be predators as well. But because she was so heavily decomposed at the time she was found, investigators were unable to determine if Jocelyn actually was sexually assaulted. If she wasn't, then I'd be curious what other potential motives there might have been for this crime. I find it interesting that if you look up Jocelyn Hickenlooper's page at the Find a Grave website, it features a photo of her tombstone, which lists her date of death as June the 12th, 1955, her 23rd birthday, even though she went missing on June the 11th. But since the medical examiner was unable to determine her exact time of death, I guess we technically can't be certain that Jocelyn was murdered on June the 11th. Her body wasn't found for over 2 weeks, so she could have been kept alive and held in captivity for a period of time after she went missing. Indeed, a group of Boy Scouts would later tell police that they were at Parley's Canyon on June the 12th and walked over pretty much the exact spot where Jocelyn was buried, but they didn't notice any indication that a freshly dug shallow grave was there. So for all we know, Jocelyn still could have been alive somewhere at this point and was buried at a later time. The big WTF moment in this whole case has to be the discovery of the wedding invitations in Jocelyn's room, which announced that she was getting married to a man from Ogden named Jerry Brown on June the 12th, the day after she disappeared. I have no idea if these invitations have any link to Jocelyn's murder, but they are such a bizarre clue. The theory which has been pushed forward is that due to her childlike mind, Jocelyn may have been living out some sort of fantasy where she wanted to get married to this Jerry Brown guy and went so far as to print up invitations for a non-existent wedding. They did track down a Jerry Brown in Ogden who was a casual acquaintance of the Hickenlooper family, but he denied that there was any romantic involvement between himself and Jocelyn, and police believe that he had a credible enough alibi that they did not think he had any involvement in Jocelyn's death. Even though Jerry claimed that he barely knew Jocelyn, if they had crossed paths and she developed a major crush on him for some reason, this may have compelled her to create this fantasy for herself. It might seem like too much of a coincidence that the date on the invitations was the day after Jocelyn originally went missing, but I suppose the alternate explanation is that Jocelyn could have selected June the 12th because it was her birthday, which only added to her fantasy. But given what a common name it is, what if Jocelyn had developed a fascination with an altogether different Jerry Brown from Ogden? One detail which has never been clarified is where exactly these invitations were printed, as I'm not sure if investigators were able to determine this. In spite of her disabilities, Jocelyn did have some level of independence and could run errands on her own, so she may have gone somewhere to get these invitations printed up without her family knowing about it. Though I will acknowledge that it is an odd coincidence that Jerry Brown's place of employment was a printing firm. Even if this particular Jerry Brown wasn't involved, it's possible that Jocelyn could have fallen prey to a 1955 pre-internet version of catfishing, where some predator lured her somewhere on the pretense that a wedding was about to take place before she got murdered. This could provide an explanation for why Jocelyn decided to leave her house without telling her family what was happening, but it doesn't really account for why she would leave while dressed in her house coat and leave her glasses behind, which she really needed in order to see anything. If Jocelyn was being manipulated by someone, it could have been a case of this person telling her she needed to leave immediately without grabbing any belongings so her family wouldn't notice she was gone. Some of the earliest reporting on this case stated that Jocelyn had been seen in a neighborhood pharmacy on multiple occasions with an unidentified man with a mustache and dark complexion. I guess it's possible that this man was a predator who could have befriended and harmed Jocelyn, but it sounds like this angle was completely dropped, and I have no idea if investigators were able to find this man or figure out if these sightings had any significance. But even if these wedding invitations have no relevance to Jocelyn's murder, I'd sure love to know why they even existed in the first place. Now we're going to talk about the feasibility of Burnt Murphy having been the perpetrator of this crime. And regardless of Burnt's mental issues, and whether or not he was really responsible for the assault on that 4-year-old girl, you have to rule him out as a suspect if it was physically impossible for him to make the trip to Salt Lake City to commit the murder. Remember, he was living at the Utah State Training School in American Fork at that time, and he did not own a vehicle, yet he somehow would have had to travel 30 miles to the Hickenlooper residence, an additional 15 miles to Parley's Canyon to murder and bury Jocelyn's body, and then travel 30 miles back to the school without his absence being noticed. If Burnt had not been declared insane and committed to the Utah State Hospital, and this case wound up going to trial, I think his defense attorney would have been able to bring up a lot of valid points to generate reasonable doubt for a jury. Now, the Salt Lake City PD always maintained that Burnt was guilty because he provided details about the crime which only the killer could have known, but it's unclear what exactly those details were, and given that Burnt's interrogation and confession took place without the presence of an attorney, it would not surprise me if details could have been fed to him by investigators. Like I mentioned earlier, the world was a lot less knowledgeable about false confessions back in the 1950s and how individuals could be manipulated into admitting to a crime they were not responsible for. I know the superintendent from the Utah State Training School drew a backlash by publicly stating that Burnt couldn't have committed the crime since he was at school the entire day the murder took place, but back then, I'm sure most people still had the mentality, why would he confess if he didn't actually do it? Burnt's explanation is that he snuck out during the morning check and made it back to the school in time for the evening check, but the issue is that we need to come up with a way for him to make it from point A to point Z. Burnt's initial story was that he stole a car from a dealership in American Fork in order to make the drive to Salt Lake City and returned it there later that day after he committed the murder without anyone noticing. That sounds pretty sophisticated for someone with an IQ of 65, and it's pretty mind-blowing to look back at the original newspaper coverage and see the Salt Lake City police chief publicly acknowledge the issues with this story, even though they had already charged Burnt with the murder by that point. Another issue is whether Burnt would have even known where Jocelyn lived to begin with, but his story is that they developed a close relationship during their time together at the training school, and Jocelyn gave him her address when she was discharged from there the previous year. In the end, it sounds like the story everyone settled on was that Burnt hitchhiked from American Fork to Salt Lake City and back, which is not completely implausible, but the problem is that it doesn't account for how Jocelyn could have made it from her house to Parley's Canyon. So according to Burnt, when he arrived at the Hickenlooper residence, he convinced Jocelyn to come out for a walk with him. And this is important because at no point did Burnt ever claim that he and Jocelyn hitchhiked or used a vehicle to travel to Parley's Canyon. Burnt said that after he walked to the mouth of the canyon, he made advances on Jocelyn, but snapped and killed her when she rejected him before he used his bare hands to dig a shallow grave to bury her body. Now, following Burnt's arrest, the local newspapers actually printed a map of a possible route Burnt and Jocelyn walked from her residence to the murder scene. Burnt claimed that he could not remember the exact route, but this map showed the quickest way to travel this distance, which was around 5.5 miles. Most of the reporting states that the location of the shallow grave containing Jocelyn's body was 15 miles from the Hickenlooper residence. So unless that particular piece of information was misreported, then that's a pretty major discrepancy, and I'm surprised it didn't raise more red flags, as I have a hard time imagining that Burnt and Jocelyn could have walked 15 miles to that spot. Yes, I suppose it's possible that they could have walked 5 miles, but remember, Jocelyn suffered from scoliosis and had a hump on the right side of her back, so walking that distance probably would have been a more arduous ordeal for her than the average person. And even if they did walk 5 miles to this location, there's no way Burnt carried Jocelyn's body another 10 miles to bury her in another section of Parley's Canyon. I just don't see how this entire scenario works unless Burnt had access to a vehicle. But even if Burnt showed up at the Hickenlooper residence and convinced Jocelyn to go out for a walk with him, why would she have left in her housecoat and slippers without getting dressed? How come she left her glasses behind? If her brother Wally was still at the house, why didn't Jocelyn tell him she was leaving? And while we have a neighbor who did see Jocelyn walking away from her house that day, how do you explain away her account of there being two people at Jocelyn's side? Look, I'm not going to pretend that Burnt Murphy was a model citizen, but I just don't see how any of the proposed scenarios of him being Jocelyn's killer managed to hold up. At the time Burnt was charged with this crime, Jocelyn's murder had gone unsolved for 2 years, and the Salt Lake City Police Department had faced incredible pressure and criticism for failing to close the case. It sounds like they had exhausted all available leads and had no idea how to solve this crime, but once Burnt was charged with raping the 4-year-old, and it was discovered that he had a personal connection to Jocelyn, they realized that they had a potential opportunity to close the books on that case and coerced him into making a confession. For all we know, they may have genuinely believed that Burnt was guilty of the crime, but I'm sure they also felt that since Burnt had just harmed a young girl and was getting the book thrown at him anyway, there was no harm of pinning a murder on him which he may not have committed. It's been alleged that the decision to declare Burnt legally insane was part of a deal between the prosecutors and the Utah State Hospital, as I'm sure that the state realized that there were a number of holes in the case against Burnt and wanted to avoid taking him to trial. This also gave the authorities a convenient loophole to close the case and declare Jocelyn's murder to be solved without actually having to secure a conviction for the crime. I'm sure this case would be handled much differently if it took place today, as a lot more due process likely would have been required before Burnt was committed to a psychiatric hospital for the next 3 decades. It's interesting how Norman Ash Fackrell was charged with Gregory McComb's murder at pretty much the exact same time, even though the case against him was incredibly weak and wound up resulting in an acquittal when he went on trial. For all we know, the same thing could have happened if Burnt Murphy went to trial, and I think this situation demonstrates the extreme haste the Salt Lake City authorities were using to get some of their most high-profile unsolved murders off the books. So if Burnt was railroaded, this begs the question about who was actually responsible for Jocelyn's murder. Well, assuming that the neighbor's eyewitness sighting was accurate, the most logical explanation is that there were two perpetrators involved, but who were they, and what motive did they have for this crime? Part of me wonders if these wedding invitations did have some sort of link to Jocelyn's murder, and even if Jerry Brown from Ogden didn't have any involvement, perhaps Jocelyn was preyed upon by a manipulative person or persons who decided to murder her. This is a pretty perplexing case, and it's a real shame that the investigation was closed and all other potential leads were ignored for 3 decades because the wrong person had been shuffled away to a mental hospital. After nearly 67 years, it sounds like all the evidence and records pertaining to this case might have been long destroyed, but the fact that the local media decided to feature it as part of their Justice Files series this past November at least shows that Jocelyn's story has not been completely forgotten. So if by chance you happen to have any information on the murder of Jocelyn Hickenlooper, or if you also have info about the 1954 murder of Gregory McComb, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, I actually recorded a special bonus episode with Jules, the co-host of my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, as well as the host of her own podcast, Riddle Me That, True Crime. And we discussed the 1983 death of Nancy Argentino, the girlfriend of famous professional wrestler Superfly Jimmy Snuka, who was suspected of possibly killing her, though the case never did reach a definitive conclusion. In addition, we've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from The Path Went Chilly, in which myself, Jules, and our other co-host Ashley discussed the 1991 murder of Dick Hansen. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track which will be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Lauren M., Rebecca C., Christine V.D., Liam P., Jen G., and Penny M. Thank you all so much for your support. I'm also pleased to announce that The Trail Went Cold has been added to the lineup for Podcast Row at 2 CrimeCon events this year. So provided that it is safe enough to travel, I'll be appearing at CrimeCon 2022, which is being held at Paris and Bally's in Las Vegas from April the 29th until May the 1st. If you would like to purchase tickets, we already have our own personalized promo code to receive a 10% discount off a standard badge. Please visit CrimeCon.com and enter the promo code TRAIL. I'm also hoping to appear at CrimeCon UK, being held at the Leonardo Royal Hotel and Spa in London on June the 11th and the 12th. If you would like to get a 10% discount on tickets to this event, please visit crimecon.co.uk and use the promo code COLD22. In addition, I wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I host what is essentially an after show for each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes, so be sure to check there for more information, or visit getvocal.com. That's getvocal.com. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online Forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit, which, like I mentioned earlier, has a very interesting discussion about the Jocelyn Hickenlooper case. I need to provide a big thanks to McGill Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the ear music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week, and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. ¶¶